And you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org. I really need to work on my English. Coming up is In Context.
Such fluid introductions. Thanks, March.
Oh, I tried my best. Little bleh.
You are listening to In Context. Thanks for joining us on this beautiful Monday afternoon. I hope you're enjoying your lunch out there, everybody. This is In Context, as I said. We are on every Monday, except the first Monday of the month, from noon to 1 p.m. as part of WPKN's live call-in public affairs programming block. You can find us at incontextreport.com, and you can find us on YouTube, where we produce weekly political videos where we go into more in-depth and explain nuances of some of these really complicated military affairs, foreign relations issues, political issues here domestically, like the elections and mainstream media misinterpretations of things, so they actually are just blatantly lying to you. You can find us on YouTube. Our channel is In Context Report, so you can just go to YouTube and type into the search box In Context Report, and then you can add a space channel, and that'll bring up all of our videos. That's how you find a channel on YouTube, if you don't know that. But directly, it's youtube.com/incontextreport. Find us on Facebook as well. Like us there, and you can get our updates and everything like that. But today, we are going to be discussing the economic issues looming large over the country. We're going to be talking about the Buffett rule that Barack Obama mentioned in his weekly address last week. We're going to be talking about the proposed minimum wage increase and a couple other things we may or may not get to. But my name is Gus Cantavera. I'm here with my co-host, Ken McDermott Rowe.
Hey, good afternoon.
Is your mic up? I didn't hear you.
Yeah, it should be. You're on mic two. You're usually on mic three.
Oh, yeah, you are. Okay, you switched mics?
No, you're okay. I turned on mic two.
Okay, great. Mic two, sorry.
And we're joined also doing double duty behind the board is our military affairs commentator / board engineer extraordinaire, Marchand.
Well, thank you. Afternoon.
Ken, what should we start with today?
Well, why don't we go on to start with this recent New York Times article, it's 11 April, about the Buffett rule, because the Buffett rule seems to indicate the theme of the coming presidential campaign. The Democrats are going to play the role of the populace, and they're going to paint the Republicans, Romney probably there, yeah, looks like their nominee, as the defenders of the rich. So the Buffett rule is this proposal from Warren Buffett, who's one of the world's wealthiest people, an American billionaire, that millionaires who pay pretty low taxes generally should pay a minimum 30%, that is people who are making over $1 million a year. Mm-hmm. And it's a great proposal for Obama to push, because it has zero chance of actually passing this, mm-hmm, year. But he can use it all campaign as a sort of a political talking point to show that he's really for the average guy, mm-hmm, and that Romney, who's going to be opposed to any tax increases, including tax increases on millionaires, mm-hmm, is going to be, of course, painted in a corner.
Well, that's great, because Obama gets to paint himself as Robin Hood and make Romney as the Sheriff of Nottingham. But if you look more closely at it, Robin Hood in this analogy is actually an evil villain as well.
So it's all a game. It's not like the incomes for these guys were published in the New York Times recently as well. And Obama made $789,000, which is, I think, down from the previous year.
Actually, a couple of years ago, it was like $8 million.
Yeah, he was making millions in royalties. So he's a very wealthy person. I mean, he's pretty far from
and
you
his,
and me.
His wife was also an extremely successful corporate lawyer for Walmart.
He's big butts.
They're not hurting.
A big bucks. And sorry about that. And Romney, he had scraped by on about $21 million of income.
Scraped by.
Now, the beauty of this is that people like Romney pay generally a very low capital gains tax. I mean, mm-hmm, he's not punching a clock every day, you know, and getting paid $10 an hour or whatever. He's doing wheeling and dealing, and he's paying the much lower capital gains tax. Also, people like that pay virtually no. The payroll tax is utterly insignificant for somebody like him. What does he care about Social Security? Well, I think it's on like the first 100,000 or so. It's meaningless to him. But that's a very significant tax. In fact, your average American today is paying more in payroll tax, Social Security, and Medicare tax, and unemployment assessments and whatnot than he is in income tax. So this is really important. So actually, Obama, according to the New York Times, was paying a lower income federal tax rate than his secretary. which is also true of Warren Buffett.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be true of it's probably true of Romney as well, because Mitt Romney's effective tax rate, federal tax rate, was 15.4%. on an income of about $20 million, folks.
Because of the capital gains. None of the money he makes is from a wage.
It's
all for investments.
And maybe he has a little bit token, but certainly as a percentage of his overall income, his Social Security tax would be like 0.01%. It'd be negligible. And that'd be true for Obama, too.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys are not in our league. And so this is a game that's going on now. Of course, we've got to look at this whole Buffett rule in the context of the polarization of wealth in our society, which is one of the important characteristics of our economic decline.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at a chart, which I found that U.S. Census Bureau put out, you can see this widening gap. It really starts in the 1970s. As you go along up until then, the distribution of wealth wasn't that dramatic. But then starting around the middle 1970s, it just starts to open up wide. And you can, this chart I have that I got from the U.S. Census only goes through 2003. But even at that point, the gains from the mid-70s to 2003, the rich people had about doubled their income relative to the lowest 10 and 20%. And the middle person had just barely he had lost ground, too. He'd done a little better than the bottom 20%. So this has been going on for 30 years, and it's gotten worse.
You factor in the cost of education, health care, and the cost of living for food, fuel, and housing skyrocketing, basically, over the past 40 years.
The average guy is getting killed. And we did a show, Gus and I did a show on college costs, and it showed that college costs since this time, since the 70s, had about tripled.
It goes up, to the average percent. 6% a year is the most recent stat I heard?
We figured that about the average income since the middle 70s had gone up about fivefold, while a college tuition had gone up about 15-fold.
Mm-hmm.
So the average guy, in terms of really key things like college, because that's your ticket to social mobility, is being put out of the reach of the middle class. And, of course, medical care has gone insane.
Right.
And housing went nuts, too, until the raising housing collapse in the, about 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So we see the average – so we see this debate that's taking on but taking place now has to be seen in the context of a period of, I would say, 35 years of growing income inequality and economic decline.
So basically, if you're not getting a raise of probably 10% a year – then you're losing ground.
Especially
factoring in inflation
over this period, and of course the whole inflation measures are very, I think, unreliable.
Because they're not factoring in fuel and market based price fluctuations.
And if you're making,
certain food goes up faster than other foods.
And if you're making $1 million a year, the price of gasoline and heating oil for your house is really minuscule relative to your income. You don't care if it goes up. But if you're making the average income in the country is about $44,000.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the misleading aspects I found in this New York Times article on the the income tax, although I think it's a very good article and it makes the point that the rich pay a low tax rate, is that they mentioned the median income is $44,000, and that person pays virtually no income tax.
Median household income?
It said the median American income, not household. But if you look at in our listening area,
I find it hard to believe that it's that high.
It's not. I think it's pretty. Sounds high to me too. But if you look at the household income, median household income in our listening area in Fairfield County, New Haven County, you know, people make, with a husband and wife both working and children, they're probably making $70,000, $80,000, $90,000. Would be now they're paying income taxes.
Yeah, sure.
And they're also being shut out of a lot of college grants.
Because you're expected to pay like 90% of the tuition at that rate.
You're supposedly making too much money. So so then the question really begins, what's caused the economic decline? What's caused the erosion of our standard of living, which has Elizabeth Warren, who's running for the Senate in Massachusetts, has brilliantly analyzed in some videos you can see for free on YouTube that this erosion in the American standard of living, which she traced it to the 1970s, has been masked by massive borrowing. That's mm-hmm. the only thing that's kept the middle class
afloat. Yeah, cheap credit.
Cheap credit. It's always what's kept our government afloat,
exactly.
which now has a gross debt, which has just exceeded our annual GDP, which is a real, like, flashing red light. They were in trouble.
And who this really benefited, though, was the large corporations and the banking institutions, because they had availability to near zero credit for a long time, which they then reloaned to us at a high interest rate to pump up things like the real estate bubble, which in the end they were all bailed out. They took their bonus money. They still got their high payouts for all the executives. So they got richer. Then they bailed out at the last minute while everything else crashes in flames. So even if the government has $15 trillion in debt, the corporations are doing just fine.
That's right. In fact, the New York Times article also shows that the very rich are the ones who bounced back from the crash of 2008. The middle class people have not. But the very rich who suffered in terms of their bonuses on Wall Street after mm-hmm. the crash have recovered their ground and then some.
And gained it back.
And then some.
Yeah, they haven't lost anything.
And these point to, I think, really the long-term structural problems which go back to the 70s and which we're really talking about the end of the Vietnam War, which Johnson said guns and butter, that wasn't possible. And it led to inflation in the beginning of deficits. Mm-hmm. And it's also led us to what we call the hollowing out of our economy. As we divert needed capital from things like new business investment and infrastructure improvement, we divert it to foreign military. Mm-hmm. And this has been shown to be the root for decline of every empire by Yale professor Paul Kennedy in his really magnificent book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. The British, the Spanish, every empire before us has gone the same route. You overspend in the military, you neglect your real economy, mm-hmm. and your standard of living just keeps going down and down.
Yeah, exactly. But the point is that people hear that and they think, yeah, so we should tax the wealthy because they're doing really well, right? But I was really looking at these numbers over the weekend, and I produced a video specifically on the Buffett rule, but the idea that his secretary is paying more tax than he is for one thing, I think is a misleading argument, because the secretary makes between $200,000 and $500,000, so that she's not poor either. So
yeah.
The fact that she's paying a high tax rate is relatively justified. Warren Buffett himself makes very little in wages. All of his money
right.
comes from those that interest return. Help me with the dividend return. What is it called?
Well, capital gains.
The capital. Sorry,
right.
For some reason I can't remember that phrase. The capital gains. So he's paying that 15.5%. The same thing that Romney famously,
right.
you know, said that's what he's paying, because he just makes nothing in wages. Once you get to that point, you no longer have to work. You're just an investor at that point.
Right.
Obviously, the reason that the taxes on capital gains is low is because that money has been invested in a corporation, has already been taxed, and you're just reaping the benefits. So the idea of keeping that low is why does the money have to be double and triple taxed. That was the argument. Whether you agree with it or not, that's completely an aside. But that's the reason why the capital gains tax is set to where it is. But I don't think that Obama's use of the word fair is an accurate word. I think it's a complete misdirection, and it's a wordplay, because it's not fair to increase taxes on one group so that it reflects the unfairness of another group.
Yes.
It's fair to reduce the taxes of the overly taxed group down to the equal level of the other groups. It's fairer to reduce the taxes on the middle class. Why does the middle class have to play games with their money like the rich do in order to try to hide pennies here and there and claim minuscule deductions until they add up, just adding paperwork and work to already overly burdened mothers and fathers of middle-class families? Why don't they get a tax break in order to equal everything else? I think what the government is trying to do is create a class warfare environment, just like we use racial divisions to create racial tension and try to divide the country to make smaller, more easily conquerable groups and demographics. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying, and I think that the answer that the widening gap between the rich and the poor in this country is not the cause of our problem. It's the symptom.
It's a symptom of the problem, right.
And so just raising taxes on the rich, I think we shouldn't have this disparity, but that's not going to solve our
structural problem. Exactly, because it's only going to raise $47 billion over 10 years. In contrast, our deficit is just widening every day by many billions.
$1.5 trillion this year.
We have $15 trillion in debt right now, so raising $47 billion over 10 years is not going to do anything. What it is going to do, though, it's going to drive wealth out of the country so that more money goes down to the Caribbean tax shelters. More money gets moved over to foreign banks and more corporations move out of the country. We're not going to be enticing anyone to reinvest here in America by increasing the taxes. We already have the highest corporate tax rate in the entire world. Japan just lowered theirs down to 38.5% so that they're a full percentage point lower than the United States. So if you think that raising taxes in order to increase fairness is going to increase prosperity, then you are deadly wrong. What instead is going to do is just further send us down the spiral. People think it's more fair. It makes them feel better in the near term to hit someone who hit them first. But two wrongs don't make a right, well, and that's not going to fix
at
anything.
At the risk of sounding like a Republican, and we are not partisans.
We're not
Republicans or Democrats. We try to follow a line which we think is best for the country. It's not an ideological line. It's a people oriented line. That's if we have any political bias, it's towards the popular government as opposed to corporate government. And that what we saw in the 70s, as well as this, the problems with the war, the oil, of course, the oil crisis, the OPEC oil boycott, which really hit a whammy to our economy, was the beginning of this trend towards leverage buyouts, towards taking firms over, the financialization of the American economy, which we get rid of our manufacturing sector. And some of the players in this LBO business, which burgeoned in the 80s, William Simon, this guy had been former Secretary of the Treasury under Nixon and Ford. And this guy starts a leveraged buyout firm. And like a lot of people who came after him, they buy firms, they sell off pieces, they get rid of a lot of jobs, and they turn them around, they make a lot of money, and the jobs end up in a foreign country.
Right.
And we end up losing, and what we have lost since the 70s is our high-paid manufacturing jobs, and we get low-paid service jobs. And this has been going on. It was documented in a 1982 book by a guy named Barry Bluestone and Bennett Harrison called The Deindustrialization of America. That's going back 30 years that they were documenting this trend of companies being shut down and the jobs being moved overseas. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how do we reverse that process? Mm-hmm. How do we get the good-paying jobs back here, which are going to restore the standard of living to our middle class? And this is, of course, a call-in show, and we would be delighted to hear your views on these questions. The name of the show is In Context, if you just tuned in on WPKN 89.5 FM. My name is Ken McDermott-Rowe. I'm here with Gus Condivero and Marchand McDermott-Rowe. And our phone number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or if you'd like to share us your thoughts or your questions by email, drop us a line at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. We have our laptops open, so we get your emails right away and we can respond to them.
You know, and the trick, you know, is those high-paying jobs, those manufacturing jobs, those really good quality jobs that people can go on to. It's those service sector jobs that are paying $7, $8, $9 an hour should not be for mothers and fathers with children.
That's right.
That wage really should be for high school and college kids who just want some spending money. You're not going to get anywhere on $18,000 a year.
And we need to talk about that, the minimum wage.
It's the working poor.
Yes, we do. This is Tom from Watertown. Go ahead, Tom. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Tom.
Hi,
thanks
Tom.
For calling.
How are you?
Thanks. Good.
You know, it goes back to like some of the basics of that old movie where he got up and said, greed is good, and we certainly know that line.
Right.
And to get that culture to change, and it's like getting humanity to change as a whole. It's a big, big step forward.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got it, you know, when you got people that aren't getting the media attention they deserve in the race, and they're not getting integrity and honesty and consistency,
mm-hmm.
People of that nature to listen and to say, you know, that's right, and that's what we like, there's nothing to talk about. There's nothing to air if it's consistency and honesty and proof. There's nothing to talk about. There's nothing to dissect. There's nothing to disseminate. So it's a tough call because, you know, if you throw greed out of the picture, things will get better. That's tough to throw out of the picture. And therein lies the whole culture mess is more for me and more for me and more for me. And it goes right down to our children and on and on and on. How do we change that?
Well, it's definitely hard to eliminate a human quality like greed. So who are you referring to as in people who are not getting the appropriate attention in the race?
Well, you know, Ron Paul.
Uh-huh.
To, as I'm alluding to, it's just the consistency and some of the basics and some of the real proof, the documented. Mm-hmm. He said this, that happened. He said that, and it did come to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just, if that can be geared, and the internet, of course, is such a great,
yeah.
Other, of course, NPRs and so forth, is such a great medium. And if there's ever gets to the point where that medium is also squished due to regulations and
right.
False accusations, then we're really a mess. And you didn't think, I would never think I got 90% of my news on the internet and NPR, but that is my vice, if you will, to say, geez, I can't just crawl in a hole.
Right. Well, thank you very much for the call, Tom.
Yeah, thanks
thank
a lot,
you very
Tom.
Much,
well put points, opinions. When we had Bruce Fine on, you remember we had a listener email who asked what...
Bruce Fine is a spokesman, national spokesman for Ron
thank
Paul.
Thank you.
Right?
We had a listener email question who asked what would Ron Paul do to stem the corruption of lobbying in Washington, D.C.? And Bruce Fine's answer was, if you eliminate the powers of the government to be able to afford benefits to lobbyists, then there is no longer a reason to lobby unless you just really believe in the issue, right? So if you get rid of the government's ability to dole out corporate welfare and freebies to be able to make the climate more comfortable to big corporations and favor them so that they are crushing their competition, there no longer is a reason to have lobbyists on K Street. So the answer to returning manufacturing jobs is to get rid of this favoritist environment so that the big corporations send their high-paid million-dollar lawyer lobbyists down to Washington or buy up former congressmen who have influence and they're able to run around and glad hand with their former colleagues. Then you have competition springing up all over the place, and these big corporations become not too big to fail, but too big to succeed, and they have to crack themselves up and sell off portions of the company in order to make it through.
There's a myth that the Republicans stand for small government. I think Ron Paul is the exception to that,
yes,
because
yes.
I think he really does. But it's – yes, go ahead, Marshawn.
No, I was going to say, I think there's this myth as a whole that the that – any of the political parties are, you know, ones to the right and ones to the left. You have,
yeah.
You have this middle line that's absolutely neutral. You have the Republicans slightly to the right, Democrats slightly to the left. But in reality, they are all these ultra-capitalists.
They all want the same thing.
Neither of them are nationalists. Both of them – one puts a little bit more into defense than the other. One puts a little bit more into social welfare than the other. But all they're concerned with in their entirety is profit. There is no sense of nationalism. I know.
Yeah,
you guys...
like the Democrats, they would say, "Well, we want welfare, and we're going to give it to Citibank to dole out the debit cards for food stamps." Like, who
exactly.
does that benefit? That benefits Citibank so that they can make profits on doling out welfare.
Exactly.
It's still just a corporate giveaway.
Which is why, you know, I mean, you guys were talking about, you know, we don't identify as Republican or Democrat, and that's why when people ask me, "What am I?" I don't say I'm a Republican or a Democrat. I'm a nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I believe in America first, and that's
opposed,
a problem.
As opposed to GM first or the corporate, if you look at every public policy in this country, it's shaped by the large corporations that are affected by it for their benefit.
Yeah, well, and that's the whole point with the lobbyists. You know, it's always a corporation first, it's GM first, it's Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac first, and then we put other countries. Foreign policies before our own. It's Israel first. It's Saudi Arabia first. It's, you know,
and
we're
going to
build bridges in Afghanistan, and we can't provide health care here.
Halliburton and Exxon, of course.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. But and you bring up Halliburton as, you know, the military contractors, and that is one of the biggest problems that we have. We are spending billions of dollars, as you just mentioned, building bridges in Afghanistan, but we don't have health care here. We could be spending money upgrading our infrastructure, building bridges here, where we have completely decaying, decrepit infrastructure. Our bridges are falling apart. Our railways are terrible. They're all cramped and stuffy and falling apart. That, you know, in a lot of places in the country, driving a car goes faster than the train because you can't take a turn at higher than 40 miles an hour.
And how many jobs would that create?
It would create many, many jobs.
Look at any case throughout
buying
history.
American steel for the railway. You know, I mean, do you have any idea what kind of
bringing manufacturing back here? I mean, that's another thing that I know I'm launching into a tirade, but this is another thing which drives me absolutely insane. We allow corporations to say, okay, we're going to take all these blue-collar jobs, steel manufacturing, car manufacturing. I mean, people say, buy American if you want to keep your job. That is a load of things I can't mention on the radio because all the American cars are manufactured in Mexico and China. When you buy a product, an American product that's manufactured in China or Mexico, instead of the money that you spend, you have surplus, you spend it buying a car, which goes to then pay the salary of an employee who then goes to spend his surplus at wherever you work, thus continuing the cycle of life. If you go and you spend that money and it goes to pay some, you know, poor Chinese sweatshop or pay some Indian sweatshop or some Mexican sweatshop, it's not given nothing. It's nothing's coming back into the country. It's a one-way hemorrhaging of money. Mm-hmm. And we allow these corporations to ship our jobs, to ship our... I mean, this is terrorism in of itself. This is...
It's financial terrorism.
It's financial terrorism.
Max Kaiser, the financial analyst, he coined the phrase financial terrorism.
Exactly.
Suicide bankers.
It's treason.
And they don't have the national interest at heart. They don't have the people at heart.
No, it bleeds the country dry. And you look at areas like Toledo, Ohio, where I used to live. I mean, the place looked like Fallujah the morning after, and I'm not even exaggerating. Boarded up, burned out city blocks, all because we allowed a bunch of industrialist goons to ship their jobs overseas.
And see, it's not wrong necessarily to import products, all right? It's not wrong to buy a product another country can make better or cheaper than you can in your own country. We're not advocating protectionism. A real free market says that you just don't favor one market over another. Like here we have tariffs on American sugar. Right. So you can import sugar from another country cheaper than you can buy American sugar. And that's why sugar is so expensive, because it's just competing. I'm sorry. It's the other way around. It's the tariffs on foreign sugar and then American sugar is cheaper. But the thing is that American sugar just rises up to the cost of the tariff in order to make.
Well, this is a problem. I think that tariffs have played a big role in the growth of the American economy. But you obviously don't want a situation where you just inflate the prices. Products by protecting your homegrown manufacturers. I don't know exactly how. I mean, that's a pretty complicated policy, but it can be worked. And that's what made us America a great country in the 19th century. We had selective tariffs, which nurtured American industry. And
especially in the cases of China where they have slave labor. Well, you can't compete with that.
Well, that's just it. I mean, we're talking about, we have to compete with the Chinese and things like that. There is no way on earth we are going to compete with, a factory that pays its employees 25 cents an hour at best. How the heck are we going to compete with that?
Maybe has no OSHA, no union.
Working 100 hours a week.
Yeah, people die. They just kick them to the curb.
Seven days a week.
Exactly. But we have to, part of that, should be just humanitarian. We should not, on principle, if we call ourselves a democracy and want to be a world leader, we should just, on principle, not buy something that's made in a sweatshop.
The tariff should level the playing field. Say, okay, you guys are going to be penalized.
The government should encourage businesses to come back and build industry. One of my favorite examples is you look at the United States. I mean, this is an American example. I could come up with 100 foreign examples, but this is an American example. We come out of the Great Depression, and what is the first thing that happens? What is the first thing that FDR does? Well, not just to mention the outbreak of World War II, we start things like building roads, building bridges, the factories, the armaments industry booms, and you employ all these volumes of unemployed people. Because, anyone who can stand up, walk, talk, and breathe can work in a factory and make a livable wage.
That, and when you talk about infrastructure, it brings me to another important myth that's bandied about, especially by so-called conservative Republicans, which is that the government has no place in promoting the growth of the American economy. And if you look at our history, the government played a very important role, going right back to the earliest days. Thomas Jefferson's administration, the Secretary of the Treasury, drew up plans for expansion of the water systems. And there was no greater proponent of government fostering of economic growth than the first Republican president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln. If there's one central theme to his career, although we know him mainly as a Civil War president, it was the promotion of infrastructure, the promotion of economic growth, whether it was back then, it was railroads, it was canals.
Mm-hmm.
He sponsored the Transcontinental Railroad.
Yep.
He also sponsored government initiatives to develop our intellectual capital. He's the father of the state college system. He created the land grant system.
Mm-hmm.
He founded, I believe, the predecessor to the National Science Institute. So the guy was a real activist. He didn't see big government in terms of the way we do it today as heavy regulation or huge spending programs. He saw it as the really the voice of the people to create a very prosperous country.
Well, government actually has more of a constitutional placehold in promoting the prosperity of the country and the planning of the infrastructure than they do in the micro regulations of industry. You know, running
right.
down to the minutiae, saying you can and can't do this, you can sell this there but not here, and you have to pay this amount for it, you know, price fixing and all that sort of stuff. They have no jurisdiction over
how many
that sort
days
of stuff.
You're going to spend in the hospital for this, that,
yeah.
or that.
You know, insurance, whatever. They have nothing to do with that, but they have everything to do with actually building and planning where things go. And that makes much more sense.
And it was really another Republican president who undertook
Eisenhower,
the greatest modern infrastructure program, the interstate highway system.
Yeah. And I talked to someone the other day, he probably is a, you know, Democrat progressive or whatever, and we were talking about taxation, and you know, he said he's a teacher, and he said no one wants to pay taxes anymore. No one wants to pay tax for anything. Everybody runs on getting elected for low taxes. And he said, and look at the conditions of everything. Everything's falling apart. And my point was, this country was built on low taxation. We weren't spending our money all over the world, wasting it on nothing and giving it away to mega-rich corporations. Everything was built on our labor and paying a decent wage so that we could consume the things that we built. And you didn't have to have high taxation because you had prosperity. You had even... go ahead. Yeah.
I would like to hear your thoughts on these issues. If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM. Our the station's live public affairs call-in show, and our phone number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756, or you can drop us an email at ken@mdrtalk.com. That's ken@mdrtalk.org, and we'll read your comment or your question on the air.
Just to finish my point, we didn't have the Federal Reserve until 1913. We didn't have an income tax until 1913. The income tax, again, was only for the ultra wealthy. It wasn't, and for the corporations. Constitutionally, the income tax is supposed to be on income from sales of overseas products, so only on imports and exports. Is the phone ringing?
Oh, actually it is. I'm hearing it ring outside, though, too.
Yeah, that's weird. Was supposed to just be for imports and exports, not on labor, not wages for labor. All right, the income tax is not supposed to be for wages from labor, but this country was built on that theory alone. We did not tax income from wages. You have a right to your labor. You can work and you don't have to pay tax on that constitutionally, but we have it now, and it's been accepted for a long time, so good luck getting rid of it. Once you have it, you can't get rid of it. But the regular individuals should not have to pay tax in order just to have basic local use of water and fire protection, you know?
And we have a caller. This is Brian from Long Island. Go ahead, Brian. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for calling.
Oh,
is he turned up?
Hello?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, yes, go ahead.
Sorry, forgot to turn the pot up.
Sorry about that. Everything you guys are saying sounds great, and it's all very logical on paper, but how do we eradicate this bad political scenario that we're living in?
Unfortunately, it means that we all have to be involved in the political process, which is the biggest nightmare for most people.
Only 40% of all Americans vote, which is the lowest voter turnout in the Western world, or the Democratic
Party. I mean, a lot of people who vote don't even know who they're voting for. They just show up and just pick, you know, the name that they recognize most.
What's the most constructive thing we can say in response to that excellent question by Brian?
Elect a third-party candidate.
What do you think, Brian? Is that the only way we're going to get out of this box, to go with a third party, or is there some other way?
I don't know, and I find myself, you know, it's kind of like, I feel like you're pitted in this position where you don't know which way to go. You can't, like, we're just all struggling to keep our head above water, it feels like, and everybody
yes.
you know, seems to have, behind closed doors, all these great ideas on how to radically change things back to being, you know, prosperous and
mm-hmm.
good, but nobody can actually bring that into fruition. and it's almost like amazing. I'm listening to you guys. I'm like, this all sounds great, but I feel like me and maybe 200 people are hearing this right now, and it's not enough. Like, more people need to be aware and need to hear this and need to change it, you know?
Well, that's why, I mean, I absolutely agree with you, but that's why I think if we want to get more people involved, I think a third party is the best way, because the two parties, that the two-party system that we have, neither of whom, well, first of all, people are too divided along party lines. Republicans won't vote for a Democrat, or Democrats won't vote for a Republican. That's why I think we need a third way. We need a nationalist party, a party that's going to say America first.
Or a second way, since the two main parties are really
they represent
the same interest.
Yeah, but
that's true.
But I mean, you know, a party that's going to say, we want to put America first. We want to put America's interest ahead of the corporate interest. We want the interests of the American people, the interests of the survivability of the average American to be above the profits of the corporations. Because in the end, Microsoft or Walmart or any of those corporations can survive just fine paying their employees a livable wage.
Yeah, and you know what? The biggest problem is education, because you're going to hear so much misinformation. If a third party did actually rise to prominence on saying America first, then they're going to say, oh, what, you're racist? What, you hate immigrants? Oh, this guy's a racist. He hates immigrants.
Yeah.
Well, and that's just it. You know, they'll fight you on the most asinine things. And to be honest, I have nothing against immigrants. And in fact, immigrants, yeah, we are a nation of immigrants. Immigrants are an integral part of our society. But the fact is that even they have to be paid a livable wage. The fact is nobody's getting paid a livable wage.
Brian, do you see any of your friends getting involved in politics?
No, you know what? And not to the degree that I'd be pleased with. And to be honest with you, I feel like a lot of them lost hope. It's kind of like you look at the scenario right now, and it seems like, you know, the people with the most money are the ones who are getting what they want. Like you said, these people that could send lobbyists down,
yeah,
and make things happen. And it's kind of like it's their bat and their ball. So, you know, we're just along to play with them. It's whatever they want.
Yeah, we're like backdrop.
But, you know, we can also, if it may come to this, we may have to just withdraw from the system. You know, maybe a mass tax protest might be in order. You know, because if we stop funding this machine, we won't be able to fight these wars anymore.
Yeah, and I would completely agree with that, and I think that makes sense. But it's, again, you know, you feel like, how do you get enough people on the same page to do it? Everybody is complaining. Everybody's got a problem with the system, and everybody's got something to say about it, but nobody knows how to fix it.
Congress is almost unassailable, because if you look at the amount of money it takes to run for Congress, you're talking millions. I'm wondering if some of these issues could be raised at the level where people do have a chance to get elected, like the state legislature, mm-hmm, where people could introduce a bill for nullification. Brian, I don't know if you've ever heard of that theory. Tom Baker wrote a book on it, and the idea is that the states have the inherent power, going back to it was a theory developed by Thomas Jefferson, to just say, we're not going to obey this law. We consider it contrary to the Constitution. We don't have to wait for the Supreme Court to say it's unconstitutional. For example, the state legislature in Connecticut or New York could pass a resolution saying none of our National Guard will we allow them to go abroad to fight foreign wars because they're unconstitutional.
That's an illegal order. We're not going.
They've never been declared. I mean, do you think that at the local level there might be some way to get a grip on this, Brian?
Well, then, you know what, I definitely think that if you scaled it down a little bit and you brought it down to a local level, I think that then that's the beginning of the battle, at least.
Right.
And, you know, like any problem in life, you start small and, you know, you work your way up. It's too, like, the problem is too massive to take it on at once. So
you're
I agree with you. That's very thoughtful.
Well, we thank you very much for the call, Brian.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you very much. I appreciate everything, and keep up the good work, guys.
All right, you keep fighting.
Thank you.
I think that the local level is really the key, and that's why the national media tries to completely alienate the local elections. They pay very little attention to Senate and congressional races. They don't even mention gubernatorial races. It's all about the national stage because it makes people feel powerless. We're just spectators watching this game play out.
Yes.
We have no say in it, and you can't make a difference on the presidential election. So where you can make a difference is on your state senator, your state reps, your town mayors, your county sheriffs. These are the people who really make a difference, but it takes tens of millions of dollars to run for a state senate or, you know, the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
Like Linda McMahon, she thinks that she is valuable because she's got millions, but she doesn't have any useful information. She's got no opinion on anything important.
How does that make us a democracy? And this is what I think one thing people need to think about is, how can we be a democracy when the only people we elect are people with millions of dollars? I mean, because we still fundamentally, if we have the power. I mean, I think that's one thing that never gets said often enough. We fundamentally, if people can wake up and people can look towards, you know, a another candidate or a third party. You shouldn't need millions of dollars. The only reason we elect these people who are millionaires is because they're putting their faces on TV all the time. But we could, if we wanted to, vote for Joe the plumber. Yeah. If the American people can decide that having millions is not as important as being a good, honest American.
Yeah, and you know the emotion that was being expressed by Brian, the last caller, is like the Hunger Games, you know, the popular movie right now and the popular novel series, where these children are reaped out of the they have the reaping, it's called, where they select a boy and a girl from each district to go to the games to fight to the death, and the winner gets more food and wealth for the rest of their lives. They get plucked out of this poor, treacherous, you know, poverty stricken districts with no food and everyone starving to death, and then they throw them into these games to die, basically, and everyone's forced to watch it, and they cheer for the deaths, and they just want their district to win, right? So they feel powerless, and they go along with it because that's the game, and they have this enormous cruelty being pressed upon their throats. We feel like we're powerless. We just watch this spectator game, and we go along and we vote because we're told to, but we are powerless to actually affect the outcome. Where, like in the Hunger Games, that the people protested and didn't send anybody and they revolted. Like, there's a scene in the movie where they revolt and they actually tear up the TV screen and push down one of the towers because they're sick of it. And they're just completely insulted and realize that they're being treated like filth. That's what we have to realize. We have to take the power back and realize that we are looked at as just pawns in a game.
And we have a call. This is Richard from Long Island. Go ahead, Richard. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for calling.
Hi, you're welcome. You know, I think some of the things that you folks are saying are just larger generalities and idealistic. And many of them I don't think connect with one another.
Okay.
And one of the things, you know, you're talking about, you know, the great way this country was built. And we ought to go back to that. But a large part of the way this country was built was on slave labor. African Americans being enslaved in the South, Chinese workers being indentured servants to build the railroad that you were talking about.
We have the population now. We don't need slave labor. So I mean, that point is not really relevant.
Well, it is relevant because you said that that's what we should go back to. The idealistic way this country was built.
Richard, I want to be quite...
But that's on sand.
Richard, I want to be quite specific.
Yeah.
The Erie Canal, 1820s, okay, it made New York City the premier port in the United States, perhaps the world.
And not built with slave labor.
It was built by the behest of a politician, a Democrat named Governor DeWitt Clinton of New York. I believe the entire thing was paid for with public funds, employed a lot of people. The programs we talked about that Abraham Lincoln pushed, actually he was an advocate of immigration. He promoted bringing a lot of people because the country was, the economy was expanding so fast. He even set offices up in Europe to encourage people to come here. So it's really a pro-labor policy, but we're talking about specifically about infrastructure that was led by the government. It was called, if you look at a guy named Henry Clay, he was a Whig, and he was the idolized by Abraham Lincoln. He founded something called the American System, and it was a coherent system of infrastructure improvement design and tariffs designed to foster the growth of the American economy. So I'm not talking about vague nostalgia. I'm talking about Henry Clay, the American System, Abraham Lincoln, and specific programs that built this country's economy.
Well, okay, but saying that built the country's economy and ignoring what else built the economy builds a false picture.
Well, this is the initiative.
You're leaving out the slave labor. You're leaving out the coolie labor.
But slave labor slave labor wasn't the backbone of American industry. It was the backbone of the cotton industry in the South. But when we look at the industrial America, really, I think, because the cotton industry is not really relevant to today because we don't have a big agrarian society. But it's the analogy I think we're part trying to make is the industrial America, which was the average hardworking blue collar American in the factories, the people that built the Erie Canal. That's the principle we want to go back to.
But
again, things weren't perfect back then. But we're trying to get back to the principle that built the Erie Canal and that built all this great industry.
Well, then I think you ought to be specific instead of making grandiose generalizations.
Well, we're very.
But Well, hang on, though. Wait a minute. I'm going to make an analogy, but I'm not going to compare the human labor that was used back then to machines. But what I am going to say is that the people back then were used in the place of modern machinery that we have now. They were necessary back then in order to achieve massive work projects, but that's not necessary anymore because we have modern machinery. The need for slavery has been completely removed. So, the cost would be equivalent. Back then, the cost of slaves was basically the same as the cost of horses.
You know, removed at all. It's just been sent to China and Vietnam and other countries that are, that.
But is your point to say that
labor? So it's just the movement of capital.
But is your point saying that we could not return to that because we don't have slaves anymore?
No, I'm saying we can and we have returned to that. We've just moved it offshore. I'm not saying that's the whole picture, but what I'm faulting you for is leaving it out of the picture when you spoke about the idea the Elias Pact.
I don't think it matters because back then... No, your point doesn't matter because the middle class benefited from the outcome, whereas today only the wealthy reach an outcome that benefits them.
Let's be clear, Richard. Are the whole program that we're talking about.
You know what,
policy
I think you ought to talk a little slower. You know, I mean, I know what the fact is that I'm saying that a system existed and plenty of people up north benefited from slavery. It wasn't only the plantations that benefited. The bankers up here,
I
think we're starting to get a little off topic, little off track. So,
yeah, thanks for calling, Richard.
I have to go.
Thank you. Right, thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
And we have another caller. This is Tony from Danbury. Go ahead, Tony. You're on the air with
WPKN. Hi, Tony. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good afternoon. I like the way things are livening up.
We're going to try to keep it interesting as best we can.
And I would agree in a parallel with the previous caller as to the issue of slavery, but it's the understanding of what is the definition of slavery and how has that been a dominant concept throughout history? And was there ever really a time in this country where people who had either political or financial control did not have a clear distinction between those who serve them and those who are their peers?
I think, you're really, to put it in the modern context, we're really talking about you have to have a reasonably fair distribution of wealth in a society in order to have a stable democracy. And that's what we're losing here. And this has been recognized really since the time of the ancient Greeks.
I'm glad you mentioned that because from that point, things devolved to feudalism and tribalism. And if you think about this country, the argument up until the Civil War, which also included ownership of persons as well as an agricultural base compared to a manufacturing base, up until the Civil War, there was a constant debate in this country between states' rights and national rights. The Civil War kind of worked that out, but at a terrible cost.
Mm-hmm.
Things are reverting to the feudalistic idea through the device of a corporation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we haven't really gotten that far into the democratic experiment.
Yeah,
not to the same degree.
I think that's a very good analogy, Tony. I think this idea of feudalism, corporate feudalism,
corporate serfdom,
describes really where we are today.
Yeah, I think that
exactly. And if you look at the most of the people in the rest of the world are treated as serfs or slaves. And that's a status quo.
Yes, exactly.
So the corporations are simply doing what other peerages or sovereign states or countries, however you want to describe it, they're doing the same thing when they're adapting to the international market. So
So the question is, how do we break the corporate control?
I think that I don't want to get really sidetracked on this point of slavery.
Thank you very much for your call.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Tony.
I think the overall...
You break the corporate control.
Yeah, no, let me just respond, but thank you very much for the call. I think the point is that we admit that there was slavery, there was black slavery, there was Chinese slavery, there were indentured white slaves coming from Europe to come over to the United States at the same time as we had black slaves. There were many thousands of white indentured servants here. And even the colonialists could have been argued to be slaves or serfs of the crown in England and Spain or wherever, here in Canada and the United States. The point is, we broke the idea of servitude in this country post 1900, when working conditions in the factory floors improved, when you no longer had to live on the company store, so that they were paying you just enough to buy the company products in order to live, where you were actually able to have upward mobility and escape that the orbit of the corporation so that you could actually buy a house, start a business, and actually compete with the corporations that used to rule this country. The whole point is that since we have become more centralized here, we have reverted back to this corporate serfdom. So that now everyone is just working for the company store. Walmart employees earn enough to buy products from Walmart made with Chinese slave labor.
I just want to let listeners know, we just have about 3 or 4 minutes left in the show.
Okay. 3 minutes.
3 minutes. So we have time for one quick call. If you want to give us a ring at 203-336-9756.
So we don't want to get sidetracked on this whole slavery issue. The whole point is we could have it better. We could have independence and we could have small, decentralized governments around the country serve the locals. Right.
And fundamentally, when you become a slave to a corporation, is it any different? I used to work not that long ago in a restaurant for $8 an hour. I worked 70 hours a week just to try to keep a roof over my head. And I was abused as an employee and horribly. But I couldn't argue against it. I couldn't argue against how I was treated because if I did, I'd lose my livelihood and I'd end up on the streets.
Exactly. You're back on welfare. Even you still qualify as welfare making $8 an hour. Where exactly are we getting?
Our minimum wage is a slave wage.
It's a complete joke.
If
it was indexed to inflation, it'd be what, $17 an hour right now?
Right.
Which, you can argue that's not bad.
It was indexed at the cost of college. I think it would be about $25 an hour. Listeners probably can imagine I have a child in college. Yeah. Do we have another call?
We do, Marshawn. Actually. This is John from Stratford. We have a couple people on the air. I don't know if we're going to get to all of them. But
okay, John, thanks for calling. You're on the air. If you can make it brief, we just have a minute.
I think that you have to get into the specifics of what you're going to do. You've spoken very well about what's going on.
Yes,
generally.
You can. Yeah. Question
or unfortunately, we only have an hour.
Give a whole list of people who are suing the federal government and local government on various issues that go to decentralization as opposed to centralization.
That's a key. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it. Your comment with that, but thank you very. Thanks very much, John.
And we have one more comment
from Bill from Easton. If I can figure out what I'm doing here, go ahead, Bill. You're on the air with WPKN.
Thanks for calling. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Sure. Do you have to bring it back to where it was, or are you going to have to deal with what is? And the what is the incredible weather and crisis you're going to find when it's too hot to grow food and too, insane with the weather, just slaughtering people, maybe by the dozens, but maybe more if you have tornadoes and more tornadoes. Look at our weather here, 80 degrees and no rain.
It's really bizarre. Well, thanks for that, bringing that to our attention too, Bill. We'll have to move on. Do we have one more call?
Great.
Thank you very much.
Bill.
One last one. This is Bob from Long Island. Go ahead, Bob. You're on the air.
Yes, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I know it's pressed for time, but yes. I really don't think people grasp the depth of what you're talking about.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, it's almost like hopeless. Even in my neighborhood, you can't get two people to even agree on the principle of the things you're talking about, and I think that's where it starts. Somehow we've gotten so divided, so all these lines are just drawn, and people are just arguing, I think, over their own prejudice. I don't know how to say it, but it's ridiculous. You can't, I don't know, my one neighbor, he's been in manufacturing, got outsourced, but yet he still defends this old line thinking that some of the other callers reference. And Anyway, I can't really get this thought across. I know it was.
You know, Bob, we're going
to have to get going.
But we're going to have to continue this conversation very soon.
Yeah.
And thanks so much for your call, Bob. And thanks to all our listeners for joining us this afternoon. It's In Context, WPKN 89.5 FM. We'll be with you next Monday from noon until 1 p.m. And our website is
IncontextReport.com. Visit us on YouTube, youtube.com/IncontextReport. See ya.
Let's go out with some patriotic.
On the old Liberty Tree.
Remember to pay your taxes.
The tall old tree and the strong old tree. And we are the sons, yes, we are the sons of liberty. March along with the fight, for boys, we were born forever free. Let's go pay the piper, boys, beneath the Liberty Tree. It's a tall old tree and the strong old tree.
5 FM in Bridgeport and streaming online at WPKN.org.